future. There are no people in the future.
No people at all.
There are no people in the future.
Where did all my people go?
There are no people in the future.
Let me try my people call.
Hey everybody, welcome. It is Friday, June 11th. Yes, we're getting on here, getting on in the days, that's for sure. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Now, each week I normally am talking to, you know, that vaccinated shit poster, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics, but this week Sean is making the trek cross country. Yes, he's on vacation. Yes, like, you know, it's totally like National Lampoon vacation kind of thing. We're getting picture updates, you know, follow him on Twitter and Instagram. He was not impressed with the St. Louis arch, for example. His parents refused to stop at any dispensaries, for example. Yes, that's the kind of excitement that Sean is living right now. But Sean will be back in a couple weeks. I'll have some more announcements about some stuff coming up. We are streaming live. Yes, we are streaming live on our YouTube channel, right? Yes. So for those of you who are not there, might be tuning into the podcast right now, make sure that you go over there and subscribe. Smash that subscribe button, right? Smash that subscribe button. Like this stream, right? And hit that little bell over on the right hand side there, so then you'll know every time we go live. We're gonna have more shows coming up, you know, in over the course of the summer. We're gonna be trying out some new things, so you want to make sure you have that kind of notification bell struck so that you'll be able to hop on, join the conversation whenever we're there. We also want to make sure that you kind of check out our Discord channel, our Discord server, sorry. Information about that is in today's show notes. You can check that out too as well. And if you're watching on YouTube, it's right down below the show. On today's show, Joe Manchin decides to sink hopes of passing voting protections laid out in the For the People Act. Yep, took out an editorial in West Virginia newspapers to spew nonsense about bipartisanship. Yeah, his move happens, of course, while Republican state legislatures are passing voter suppression laws at a breakneck pace. A similar fate awaits Biden's infrastructure plan as Manchin and Sinema refuse to get rid of the filibuster, and talks between Biden and West Virginia's Republican Senator Shelley Moore Capito fell apart. Yep, they fell apart this week. Surprise, surprise. You know, after the Republicans basically didn't want to have any new spending and just want to rearrange some, you know, chairs on the Titanic, Biden's like, nope, sorry, this is, we're done. But it was clear that, yes, Republican position, this is from a statement from White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, that the Republican position, quote, did not meet the essential needs of our country to restore our roads and bridges, prepare us for our clean energy future, and create jobs. Now, a new, like, ballyhoo moment in D.C. press is going on. A new bipartisan proposal from a group of 10 senators led by Kyrsten Sinema and Mitt Romney was developed late yesterday, but it sounds like it will gut all investment, or most investment, in climate infrastructure. Senator Ed Markey and other Democratic senators basically have already come out and said, gave a little press conference, was on Chris Hayes last night, and said, look, they're not going to vote for a bill that does not invest in necessary climate infrastructure. Like, that is the red line, and I'm 100% by this. I remember way back at the beginning of the year, there was the kind of, like, forced to vote kind of thing, right? You know, people like, we're going to force to vote, and there was all that kind of stuff on Twitter and online. Well, this is a perfect example of when you want to exercise your power. This is a perfect example of when you draw that red line and say, if there's not climate stuff in here, nope, we're done. We're done. We'll talk more about that in today's show. And it turns out that Trump's Justice Department was secretly subpoenaing, that's a weird word, phone and other records from Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee, you know, during the early days of his administration. Yes, yes. How about that? Adam Schiff's records were pulled from Apple, and then Apple had a gag order put on it, so it couldn't tell anybody. They just found out of all this stuff a couple weeks ago. In super huge news, Keystone XL pipeline, yeah, it's dead. It's dead. Yes, That's huge news. In today's PA focus, PA Republicans propose major changes to the Commonwealth's election law, calling on stricter voter ID rules and restrictions on early voting. PA Republicans spent a good part of the week with attacks on women's rights. Yep, that's it. Passing more restrictive anti-abortion laws. The PA State Senate also gleefully passed a bill that prohibits PA Health Secretary from, quote, mandating stay-at-home orders, imposing masking and social distancing guidelines, and ordering business closures. Crazy. And the PA legislator also voted to end Governor Tom Wolf's pandemic disaster declaration this week. Yes, Republican Senate Majority Leader Kim Ward joyfully proclaimed, for all practical purposes, the state of the emergency in our Commonwealth is over. You see, because a pandemic is over when we just stop, like, acknowledging it, right? As long as we're not looking at it, it'll go away, right? Insane. And Pashi held hearings this week, right, about the plans to consolidate 6 universities into 2. And Chancellor Daniel Greenstein spent much of the hearing happy texting on his phone. Yes, as several people, especially the folks over at Pashi Defenders, pointed out, he seems to be kind of spending a whole lot of time not paying attention to people who are coming here to talk and, like, happy texting on his phone. However, as Bill Schachner reported in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, with over 100 individuals calling in with comments, only one person endorsed plans for consolidation. The rest, well, they had a lot to say. In today's last call, yes, it's space and beer stuff. Yeah, Jeff Bezos announced that he is going to space with his brother for Blue Origin's first crewed suborbital mission. Bezos announced his intentions in an Instagram video in which he said, quote, You see the Earth from space and it changes you. It changes your relationship with the planet, with humanity. It's one Earth. I want to go on this flight because it's the thing I've wanted to do all my life. It's an adventure. It's a big deal for me.
Yes, that warm, fuzzy feeling you get when the richest person on the planet gets to live out his boyhood dreams built on the back of the massive exploitation of Amazon's workers. Just fills your heart with joy, doesn't it? Doesn't it? Really? Another space news, NASA says that Russia may pull out of the International Space Station. Now, Russia has been a key international partner on the ISS since the beginning. NASA's chief administrator, Bill Nelson, is concerned that Russia may be looking to work more closely with China now that China has begun to build its own space station and has big lunar ambitions. There's a lot I'm going to talk about with this space stuff today. Not just digging down into that stuff here, but kind of setting up for some new things we got happening here at Raging Chicken. I also want to give a shout out to the folks at Notch Brewing. Now, you know, the past several weeks, I have been talking about how, given all the revelations that have come out, the explosive reporting about the kind of misogyny and sexual abuses and discrimination that's been taking place in the craft beer industry with women. Again, this is not something that is brand new. Let's be clear about that. But the range and the depth and the scope of the stories that have been coming out, thought basically going to put a pause on making kind of craft beer recommendations until some of this stuff sorts itself out. And I've been, thinking about how we go ahead and kind of approach this kind of on the show. And one of the things is, and I'll talk a little bit more about this in a second, but we've got a member of the Pink Boots Society. Pink Boots Society is an organization that supports women in brewing, right? And has been at the forefront of kind of, you know, combating some of the sexism in the industry. We're going to have Aaron Wallace from the Phillies Pink Boots Society on the show to talk some about this. But I also reached out to the folks at Notch Brewing. Now, the reason why at Notch Brewing, if you recall, Brienne Allen, she was the woman who posted that Instagram post asking, you know, has anybody else experienced sexism, and it exploded, and she's been posting this stuff. She's come out and basically said that, look, you know, I'm not saying these stories about my brewery. They've been incredibly supportive. They've got a beer release that's come out that's called Brave Noise. It's a pale ale. It's brewed to show solidarity for all those who have suffered discriminatory behavior in the workplace. And now it's available at the Salem Tap Room, the Beer Garden. And they have kind of information on that. Anyways, I reached out to those folks and just said, hey,
You know, want to support it. So I kind of made a little order, got a shirt coming and things like this. But want to give a shout out. They've been fantastic. We've had some great back and forths on email. So I just want to make sure I say hello. And we've got a new show coming up on Raging Chicken. It's going to, well, I'll talk about the new show moment. It's just going to, I'll say it's going to be called Space Left, and it's going to have a little bit of a different kind of structure than our previous ones. More details about that in today's last call. I want to remind you to tune in to the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern. You can stream the show live at freespeech.org. You can also tune in the Dish Network, DirecTV, or through the Free Speech TV app on Roku. And make sure to subscribe to the Rick Smith Show's daily podcast on iTunes, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts. And you absolutely must check out the newly launched Sisters of the Night Caucus podcast. You can find it on Anchor, Spotify, iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. You know, ever since that first episode dropped, I've been kind of on it. This past week was phenomenal. And I learned, not only did I like learn, not let's say learn, but not only was it kind of involved with the conversation around kind of like the struggle for trans rights and things like this, kind of on that show this week. Maria Montano, I'm getting her name right. She was on the podcast. Talking about some of these issues, but I learned about tea berries and I learned about the Center County Fair and all the scandal around it. So, I mean, look, I'm not going to say more about that. You just got to check it out. Check out Sisters of the Night Caucus podcast. It's absolutely fantastic. They get new episodes every week now. The amazing PA women stirring the cauldron behind this podcast rock the house, and they know where the bodies are buried. Spooky, right? Yes, make sure to follow them on Twitter as well at the Night Caucus on Twitter. And attention gamers, The Game Inn is a Quakertown-based black family-owned gaming store. They're friends of the show. They've got everything for retro N64s, latest consoles, video games for all platforms, and loads of collectibles, action figures, and Funko Pops. You got it. And your kids get a discount for every year in their report card. How about that? Check them out on their Facebook page, The Game Inn, just like that's with two N's, The Game Inn. Look them up on Facebook. Check them out on Twitter at The Game Inn. You can ask them questions about games. You're looking something specific. You know, go ahead and message them on Facebook or shoot them an email at TheGameInPA, that's with two N's again, at gmail.com. And a special shout out to Jonathan Mann, who wrote our intro song. There are no people in the future. Check out all his great stuff on his YouTube page and follow him on Twitter at SongOfDayMan, again with two N's, at SongOfDayMan on Twitter. I also got to let you know, man, we have got some major programming coming up here in Out to Coop Live. I am really kind of like, I was about to say I'm beside myself. That's not the right word, right? It's I'm just kind of like floored. You know, usually when just kind of scheduling stuff for Out to Coop, you know, I'm scheduling a couple of weeks in advance, maybe usually kind of the week before, because they're trying to sell relatively current. Over the summer, I wanted to try out some a little bit of a different approach. Wanted to kind of say, okay, we start bringing some more authors on. We bring some folks that are looking to do some kind of a research in addition to some of the current stuff. And so I wanted to broaden it out to kind of look at some of the issues. And so I kind of put a lot of feelers to a bunch of folks, and literally virtually everybody said yes, right? Which was like scrambling for time. So I had basically more people going to come on the show than I had days left in the month that I was going to be here, because I'm going on vacation shortly too as well. So we are going to do some pre-records for some of these shows. But I was just astounded. Just to give you a sense, I'm looking for this thing real quick right here. So I'm going to have... I'm floored that this is what we got coming up. So on Monday, on the 13th, I'm the 14th, we've got Cory Doctorow coming on to talk about his book, How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism. And he's also the author of kind of multiple novels. I mean, just adult fiction, but he's also in some young adult fiction. And hopefully we're going to talk about some of this stuff here. This is, I'm holding up his book right now. It's called Little Brother. And the second book in that series is called Homeland. The book that was just released, that's kind of, it's not necessarily a sequel, but it's in the same thing. I'm sorry. It's called Attack Surface. That just came out last year. But, you know, it deals with some of the same questions on surveillance capitalism and resistance. They're really excellent stuff. And I'm really looking forward to talking to him on Monday at 7 p.m. at Out to Coop Live. And then 2 days later, right? We don't have to wait a whole week, but 2 days later on that Wednesday, right? And so in the morning, we got the Wednesday show with Cyril Michaleko. And then Wednesday evening, I'll be talking to Candida Kenner, right? She is the executive director of the New Pennsylvania Project. And we're going to be talking about the defense of voting rights, about the expanding of the electorate. And, you know, you look at what Stacey Abrams did in Georgia. Well, Candida Kenner is kind of at the forefront of an organization that's here to do this right in Pennsylvania. And I'll tell you, no time like the present. I mean, if you were to kind of align the stars and say, okay, given that these attacks on voting rights that are coming down, who do we put ahead of an organization designed to defend that? And your wish list would be, at the top would be Candida Kenner, right, for this project. And there she is, right in time to be leading this. So I can't wait for that conversation. So that is on the 16th, that Wednesday, the 16th at 7 p.m. time. And then the following Monday, right, on Monday the 21st, we've got Erin Wallace coming on. Erin Wallace is, she's one of the co-leaders of the Pink Boot Society chapter out of Philadelphia. She's also the owner of the Devil's Den, which is gastropub, phenomenal craft beer selections down there. And she'll be coming on to talk about what's been happening in the craft brewery industry around kind of misogyny and sexism and some of the revelations that are happening. I cannot wait to talk to her. And then in addition to that, right, some of the pre-records, just so you know, I've got this like amazing pre-record coming up. Dana Morrison, who's been on the show before, we're talking about what's going on in higher education and so on. She co-wrote this piece that was published in The Nation, back in 2020, but it has this super relevance to what's happening in Pashi's system right now. So Dana Morrison and Eleni Shermer, who's from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. They're two of the co-authors on this piece. There were others too as well. But I'm going to have them both on the show to talk a little bit about college debt. And I don't just mean student debt, but I mean the debt that universities and colleges have incurred, which is like almost precisely what has happened in the Pashi system, but the way that is kind of weighing down our kind of, basically our educational horizons in many ways. So they're going to be on. And then... Right. We've got to lock down the record date on this one. I've got a guy. His name is Chris Maisano. He's on the editorial board of Catalyst, which is one of Jacobin's journals. He's also a writer for Jacobin. He had this great piece in the volume 4, number 4 issue of Catalyst called "Can Labor Break Its Double Bind?" And it's looking at the questions of labor, what's happening under the Biden administration. So he's going to be coming on too as well to talk about that piece. So like I said, boom, right? And I have to say that this has also expanded how I've begun to think about what we can do here at Out the Coop. And I'm looking forward to really, really kind of like expanding what we're doing here. So here it comes, it's coming. Look, if you want the progressive future, we need progressive media. If you want to expand more shows like that, you want to increase what we're doing here, support Pull No Punches homegrown progressive media today. Become a patron of Raging Chicken. Look, it's as little as $5 a month. $5 a month. Really? Just go to patreon.com/rcpress. Look, we got rid of Trump, right? But if you see what's happening in our state legislatures right now, you see what's happening across the country, right? That didn't change things, right? Because the problem was not just Trump. It was the Republican Party, right? We all know this, right? You're watching this show, you're listening to this show, you know this, right? Even those trolls that keep on, they were kind of sending me some stuff this week, you know this too as well, even if you want to lie about it. Anyways, we're here for the fight, but we need you. Listen, become a patron. Good beer, price of a good beer once a month. That's what we're talking about. Help keep the media in the movement, the media. Become a patron for as little as $5 a month. They go into patreon.com/rcpress today. And look, if you're not ready to become a patron right now, you can move right over, hit that, go paypal.me/rcpress, and you can give us contribution of whatever you want. That's paypal.me/rcpress. Oh, God. Anyways, that was a long, drawn-out introduction, I know, but just there's like so much stuff that's going on. It's my kids' last week of school. It's the weather has been weird this week for me, for whatever reason. I'm not sick, but just kind of like I'd get exhausted at 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I think it has a lot to do with allergies. The pollen has been nasty this year. And today, this morning, it's raining. It's raining right now. And it's got me like right on the edge of a headache. So We'll probably kind of won't go the kind of the full length of the show that we've done in the past today. Probably just going to drill down a couple of these stories, and I'm really excited just to get to like about kind of where we're going on the show. We're going to do this in the last segment today, and a little bit about a little bit about some other stuff too. So some of the big news of the week has been, oh, I forgot to mention this. You know, I knew this was going to happen if I got talking about Out to Coop Live. Here's the other big deal, right? You know that Sean's not here today, right? I'll say that again. He's on vacation. You know, he's traveling with his family across country. He's trying to find kind of like, you know, where do you find a dispensary in the middle of a desert? Stuff like that. You know, it's like, you know, the trials and tribulations of Sean Kitchen's lifestyle project. I hope he's having a great time. Although he was very disappointed with the St. Louis Arch, as I said at the beginning of the show, at the top of the show, but he's like underwhelmed. He posts this picture of it. So, follow him on Twitter. You can look Penslinger at Penslinger, on Twitter, and you can learn what Sean is doing on vacation. What I did not say is that Sean will also be out next week. Right. Don't worry. You're not just gonna have to listen to just me again for a second week in a row. Right. Next week we have guest hosts. Right. I almost had a guest host this week, but I decided against it because I was not feeling great. Right. So I was just kind of under the weather. So I'm like, listen, I'll do a shorter show today. And then, but next week I am thrilled to be welcoming as co-host to the show, Shanna Danielson and Angela Valvano. I am thrilled. Yes, two members of the Sisters of the Night Caucus podcast will be co-hosting with me next week. I'm not even going to tell you what we're going to talk about because we haven't talked about what we're going to talk about yet. But you can also count on, hopefully, a little mix-up in terms of the format next week because I am so excited. I'm hitting my microphone. I'm so excited to have them on the show and basically be the fanboy for a good chunk of the show because I love what they're doing. I love what's happening with Sisters of the Night Caucus podcast. And I hope that next week, this kind of, you know, collaboration where this co-hosting thing will be the beginning of some co-hosting experiments that we're doing across, you know, over the course of the summer. But in particular, with some kind of work of, you know, reinforcing our platforms, right? Reinforcing and kind of building the networks between kind of the podcast work that we're doing. So next week, as Shanna Danielson and Angela Valvano will be on as co-host to the show, I'm absolutely thrilled. We worked all that out on our Discord. Yes, we have a Discord. Make sure if you haven't already, you look over, there's a little information in our show notes and on our YouTube description today. If you want to know how to join the Discord, that's how you do it. Just so you all know is that if you're making comments or anything like this on the live stream Discord right now, I am not logged in. It was just a little too much to be running this morning, especially since Sean's not here. But I'm looking for ways of streamlining that too as well. So if you got comments, you got questions today, I'd be happy to take them in the YouTube chat. And you can see that right behind me over there. So I'd be thrilled to do that. As a matter of fact, I welcome it today. I'd much rather kind of hear from you than for me to talk the entire time today. But anyhow, so some of the big news is this week, you know, it's all connected. So instead of just kind of going through each one of these stories, when I'm thinking about what's happening here, what's happening at the national level around, say, infrastructure and voting rights is indicative of the fight that we have before us for the next several years. This is going to be true at the national level. It is certainly true at the state level, too. So remember, we had this legislation was called the For the People Act, right? The For the People Act was going to basically give us some standardized voter protections across the country, right? And that it comes in the wake of these attacks on voting rights that we've seen in Republican-dominated legislatures across the country, right? So we've seen things like restricting voting times. We saw, like, in Georgia, they were removing kind of Sunday voting, right? Because, and decreasing the time that the polls were open and having you pass a literacy test. No, just kidding. That was Jim Crow, right? Right. But
a whole bunch of series of provisions, you know, getting a voter ID, right, with a special specific kind of ID. Right across the board. And like what we saw, and you know, we've talked about this on the show before, is like what we saw in 2010 after the Tea Party victories. We saw first Wisconsin, right? We saw these kind of like attacks on labor unions, attacks on working people, attacks on public institutions. And we, you know, initially, you know, people looked at it and said, hey, Scott Walker is really, you know, he's a jerk, right? That guy is horrible. Look what he's doing up there in Wisconsin. But then we started seeing the rollout. In state after state, we found out that what was happening in Wisconsin was not the aberration of Scott Walker, right? It was the beginning of the rollout, right? There was already a plan, right? And, you know, the legislation was, you know, almost taken in some cases word for word from the American Legislative Exchange Council's kind of model legislation, went into Ohio, went into Indiana, went into Michigan, you know, and then sure enough, we saw this coming. This is when Raging Chicken launched, because we said, holy crap, this is not a one and done. This is a plan. We better start building out our own infrastructure here, because there was no independent media in the state, other than maybe the Rick Smith Show and some few other blogs here and there. So we said, okay, we need to build this out. So that's what we did. And that was the pattern, right? And now we see a similar move when it comes to the stripping away of voting rights, right? Making it harder for people to vote, right? And that, you know, may have started in Georgia, you know, pick your place, right? I mean, but now I didn't check it this morning, but the Brennan Center, we talked about this last week, the Brennan Center's report showed that like there was already 19 states that had passed more restrictive voting requirements, right? And, you know, Chris Hayes has done I got to, you know, give the guy a lot of credit. He did a great job this week of laying out and bringing guests on that were kind of making the case, right? For, you know, what we're seeing here, you know, is number one, racist. Number two, designed, suppressed African-American and kind of, and people on the votes of people of color, and also working class communities, right? And that they have always, you know, Mitch McConnell came out with a statement this week, said, you know, we don't need to pass these things because it's already illegal to discriminate against someone on the basis of race. Well, you know, Chris Hayes, and she was on Majority Report this week too as well. Carol Anderson was on, who's done just phenomenal work on this stuff, and basically, you know, said, come on, this is a bunch of baloney. Right. This is, you know, and Chris Hayes did this montage. It looked like, what did they say in the 1960s? What did they say in the 1950s and 1940s about the restrictive legislation that was passed? Right. How was it that after the Civil War, right, in South Carolina, they had a majority black state legislature, and then within a matter of like, you know, a decade, that was all white again? How that happened? That's weird. Right. Well, it had everything to do with these restrictive voting requirements. Right. You know, we know the stories now about civil rights. We know the stories about, you know, the literacy tests that we're putting in, or the poll taxes. Right. So you had to pay to vote. Right. And things like this. And that was all declared illegal and blah, blah, blah. That was a fight. But what Chris Hayes did is went through with Carol Anderson and other points throughout the week and showed that what those like overt racists were saying, right, in the late 1800s and through the first part of the 20th century, was always stated in race-neutral language, right? Because they realized that if they stated it in explicitly racist terms and said, we want to restrict the rights of black people, then that would be found unconstitutional. So they found other ways to do this. I mean, this is, you know, if you've spent any time studying the history of kind of racism and Jim Crow and the suppression of the black vote, in this country, you know this, right? They shifted their language. They changed their language and they started looking at outcomes rather than expressions. So you know, you basically work from the answer. If you want to suppress the vote of black people, what are some of the ways that you can do it without saying that you're doing it because they're black, right? And so you do things like poll taxes. Or you do it like we've done right now in, let's say, in Georgia and some other places. You say you take away Sunday voting, right? Because you say it's the Lord's Day, even though separation of church and state, blah, blah, blah. We know that's all gone by the wayside. You say it's the Lord's Day. You're supposed to rest. Well, but we also know that that is one of the highest turnout, voter turnout days in the Black community because of the Souls to the Polls program, right? Where, you know, African-American communities would go to church and the church would sponsor buses to the polls, right? The church wouldn't tell them who to vote for. They just say, we will take you to the polls. We're going to make sure that you're going to get to the polls, right? And you all do it together and it's a community event. And then you go and vote. Boosts the turnout of African-Americans tremendously. Take that away, right? The likely result of that is going to be, you know, right? Lower voter turnout of African-Americans, right? Pretty simple. So that's the idea. And we see this now with, you know, the shortening of the times that you can vote, about producing kind of multiple forms of ID, right? The return of the voter ID laws, right? Now, again, let's be clear. There has been next to zero documented evidence of voter, like, what would we call it? Like people pretending that they are somebody else, right? And the few cases that have been found, right, ironically, right, have been perpetrated by Republicans, right? And we have some in our state, right, that they purposely voted for Donald Trump, like with the name of their dead mom, right? That happened in Pennsylvania, right? That voter impersonation garbage, right, doesn't happen. Right, it is a absolute minuscule problem, and in most cases that are found that there's somebody attempts to vote when they're not able to vote, right, they're caught, right, and most of those people who are caught are not trying to pull one over, right, they just didn't know, right, they thought they were able to vote and it turns out that they weren't and their vote wasn't counted. That's the system working, right? That's or how it's supposed to work, right? So all this voter suppression stuff that is being passed is all about suppressing the vote. Okay, so you've got this For the People Act. For the People Act was, you know, not only was it going to protect voting, it was going to standardize this across the country. And that was important because the Supreme Court, of course, eliminated the Voter Rights Act, right? Where, you know, you'd have to certain states who had a history of voter suppression, of African-Americans in particular, but Latinos as well, would have to go through this pre-clearance process anytime that they were going to try to kind of, you know, significantly change their voting procedures. That was to ensure that making sure that these voting procedures were not going to have the negative outcome, right, on people of color, Black Americans. Okay. Supreme Court got rid of that, said, hey, we're in a new day, right? We're in a new day. We don't need that anymore. Right. Turns out, boom. So what happens? Those very states and more now are all jumping on the bandwagon. So one of the things the For the People Act did is they said, hey, guess what? Let's standardize this stuff kind of across the way. Well, we're going to kind of make sure that everyone is kind of treated the same. We're not going to just pick and choose particular states. We'll do it for everybody. So you have a kind of standard procedure for making sure that these laws are fair. And the For the People Act would basically start clamping down on some of this dark money stuff. Right. Basically saying, no. You know, we're going to ensure that our election system, right, has integrity and is not being manipulated by billionaires through this dark money stuff. Right. OK, great. Right. That seems to be and it has tremendous amount of support, right, by Americans across the country. Well, you know, the problem, it passes the House, right? It came out of the House. It gets to the Senate. We've got a 50-50 Senate. Right. And so everything rests on Joe Manchin, Kristen Sinema, and these other people, Mark Warner from Virginia, who have said they aren't going to reform the filibuster. Why? Well, why does it rest on them? Well, number one, you need in the Senate, the way that it currently works is that you need 60 votes in order to beat a filibuster. Right. And the filibuster, of course, it bears repeating again, The filibuster came about as a way of ensuring that civil rights legislation would not happen, right? Yes, it existed before, but when it started to be used consciously to suppress the rights of African Americans, minorities in this country, right? That's when the right wing really kind of grabbed onto that. So when Kristen Sinema says things like, yeah, it's supposed to be about, you know, helping our bring us all together, it's a load of hogwash. That's not what happened, right? It's like, you know, that's a remaking. It's like the fantasy version. It's a Disneyification of what's happened with voting in this country. But I digress. So there's not the 60 votes because Republicans have already said we're not voting for it. Right. Mitch McConnell said, you know, basically says, do this as a personal favor to me. Right. Vote this down. Don't vote for this. So that means that they don't have the votes. And you can't take voting rights and run it through reconciliation like you have with some of these other bills. Right. You can't do it in the reconciliation budget process for a 50-50 vote. Right. For a 50 plus one vote in order to win. Why? Because it doesn't kind of it'd be a very difficult case to make that it impacts the budget. Right. And it, most likely this parliamentarian would say that, no, it doesn't count. Even if you were to make that case, and we all know what the Democrats are saying about the parliamentarian, like that she is somehow some, you know, monk on a mountain. But whatever. Again, I digress. And so the question was, is that would Manchin, right, and some of these others, right, that he's kind of basically the shield for, would he be willing to vote for voting rights? And he came out with this... It just blows my mind. Comes out with this editorial basically saying, nope, he will not. He's not only is he going to not go to the filibuster, he's going to vote against the For the People Act. Right. So just listen to this guy for a minute. Here's a little bit of it. He says, OK, here's the lead. I'll give you the lead. The right to vote is a fundamental to our American democracy, and protecting that right should not be about party or politics. Least of all, protecting this right, which is a value I share, should never be done in a partisan manner. During my time as West Virginia Secretary of State, I was determined to protect this right and ensure our elections are fair, accessible, and secure. Not to benefit my party, but all the people of West Virginia. For example, as Secretary of State, I took specific actions to establish early voting for the first time in West Virginia in order to provide expanded options for those who work or family schedule made it difficult for them to vote on Election Day. Throughout my tenure, blah, 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 party labels can't prevent us from doing what is right. Unfortunately, we are now witnessing that the fundamental right to vote has itself become overtly politicized. Today's debate about how to best protect our right to vote and to hold elections, however, is not about finding common ground, but seeking partisan advantage, whether it is state laws to seek needlessly restrict voting or politicians who ignore the need to secure our elections, right? And he said, partisan, blah, 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 we'll destroy it. So basically the idea here is that voting or passing the For the People Act, he sees, because it doesn't have Republican support, is about Democrats seeking partisan advantage. This is the most ass backwards like formulation of this that I could possibly ever imagine. So, I mean, let's just look at reality for a second, right? The Republican Party has, it's true that the Voting Rights Act used to be very, very bipartisan, right? Used to get tremendous amount of support from Republicans. Even Mitch McConnell has argued on the floor of the Senate that the Voting Rights Act should be kind of upheld. And it's a perfect example of coming together and we all believe in the vote and the rights to vote. But as soon as his Supreme Court buddy said, no, you don't need it anymore, Mitch McConnell suddenly switched gears, right? And it's gotten even worse since, you know, in the aftermath of Trump, you know, you stole my election kind of thing, right? Which is also, you know, fueling a lot of this nonsense. So the Republican Party has shifted away from the support of those rights, primarily. My thought, right? A lot of commentators have said this, precisely because the Republican Party is essentially right now a white identity party, right? And its core constituency is ever smaller. So it needs to maximize the impact of its small constituencies, right? And because, you know, you're not magically going to grow white voters overnight, you have to shrink the other side,
Right. So Republicans, both at in state legislatures and at the national level, are passing things, are pushing for legislation to shrink the number of people in core Democratic Party constituencies. Doesn't mean that everyone in those constituencies are kind of core Democratic, are Democrats, but you're playing the odds, right? So that has been a strategy for the Republicans. Now, what Manchin is says here is basically, well, now Republicans aren't going to support this. And so we can't go forward with protections of voting because they won't report, they won't support it, because we have to have some Republicans on board for it to be bipartisan to come together. But the thing is, the Republicans stopped playing by the rules. They're playing a different game now. They are seeking partisan advantage by restricting access to the voting booth. So then it becomes incumbent upon who's ever left, and that happens to be Democrats at this point, to stop it. Right? Because look, it's like the way that Manchin talks about coming together and bipartisanship, it's all in specific, like it's only if you exist in Washington, D.C. that freaking matters. If you ask Democrats and Republicans across the country, not people who hold elective office right now, but the ones who are registered and independents, they overwhelmingly support the For the People Act, just like they overwhelmingly support Biden's Job Act and his Infrastructure Act, right? So if you, that is bipartisan, right? You go, you poll all those folks and you got like 70% support, 65% support. That is a bipartisan bill. When you're talking about the people in this country. But the leaderships of the parties are different than those people. That's the fight in the Democratic Party right now, for example, right? Is that Democratic Party leadership does not represent the people. Right? And you got these progressives that are kind of, you know, jockeying for, that's exactly the struggle there too. But Republicans are lockstep with each other when it comes to the suppression of voting rights or kind of defeating Biden's agenda. It's all power politics. So what Manchin is doing, he's mistaking his experience in Washington, D.C. and his desire, right, to kind of like in that little tiny world of 100 people in the Senate, that's his vision of America and bipartisanship. And he's saying because the nutjob party, who's now kind of increasingly in favor of QAnon and believes that Donald Trump is still our president, right, that we have to get the crazies to agree with us in order to, that's insane. It makes no sense. And if you hear when reporters start asking him about this stuff, he becomes increasingly incoherent in what he's saying. Because it doesn't make any sense to anybody other than him trying to keep his job and power position in the Senate. That's it. And the tragedy here, right, is that it's going to be a handful of, we're probably three Democrats, right? Manchin, Sinema, Mark Warner to a certain degree, because he's come out, you know, he hasn't said a whole lot because he's trying to stay back from that. He's let Manchin take all the heat on the filibuster. So they won't move that. And so Manchin even went, you know, the fact that he went one step further, said not only will not go after the filibuster, but he won't vote for the Voting Rights Act or the For the People Act. Right? I mean, look, this is where we are. I mean, we can put all the pressure we want on Manchin. I'm not sure how to move that. But holy shit, people. We got to get out of this crazy understanding of bipartisanship that is locked in these people's experience in Washington, D.C. We got to think about, you want bipartisanship? Okay, fine. Right? Work in your community. Right? Talk to other people in the community. I know there's people in my community who are Republicans. Right? Who, when we start talking about what's happening at our schools, we're trying to talk about what's happening with, you know, the pandemic and all this stuff. We have a lot of bipartisan conversations, right? About, say, common sense stuff that we can do to kind of make things better, right? You know, and then, you know, around, say, masking, for example. Yes, there's a bunch of crazies around here, but there's a whole lot of people, Democrat, Republican, doesn't matter, who believe that we should kind of like mask up so that we can get through the pandemic faster, right? Hey, look, we're bipartisan. When did we become this nation? And I guess, you know, we've probably always been this way, but
But we focus on the people. We wait to see what the people in charge say before we think about what's possible. I mean, it's like, I already hear it on the news media. They're like, you see this like gradual getting ready to like throw their hands up in the air and say, oh, okay, you're ready to sound bipartisan. It's crazy. So anyways, that's kind of really the main thing I just want to dig into in this first part, because, you know, it's these talks that are happening right here are going to impact everybody. I mean, you know, this infrastructure plan that Biden is putting forward now, right? It's not going to meet the threshold of the filibuster, right? The talks already broke. So Biden, you know, attempting to kind of do some bipartisanship, which I wish he would just like freaking stop already. He tried. But so he brought in, you know, I'm sure this was like their internal ideas about, you know, what would put pressure on Manchin to get Manchin on board, whatever. So he brought in like West Virginia's other senator, right? The Republican kind of Shelley Moore Caputo. And we're going to negotiate. And, you know, again, we could have told you where this is going to end up. And certainly this is exactly where it ends up, right? The whole, everything falls apart. Why? Because the Republicans, you know, said, you know, no, we're only going to spend like, you know, like just maybe we'll get up to like $900 billion or something like this on this. And it wasn't going to be new money for investment. It was just going to be a reshuffling of existing money and put into this particular package. So, I mean, when you actually get at the numbers of it, like the numbers that were there for investment already, it was pitiful. The fact that, I mean, like if you were whatever, like, a, you know, like a bipartisan dogmatist, you know, I mean, you got to give all your credit in the world to Biden. I mean, he did everything you possibly can. I mean, in ways that was going to threaten some of the core aspects of that plan. He tried to make this deal and it completely fell apart. Right. And now there's this new bipartisan group, right, that Biden kind of like, so come on, get together. You got Mitt Romney and you've got Kristen Sinema and a bunch of these kind of other folks that are quote unquote moderates. Right. And they come up with a bill. But, you know, all indications are so far. And again, there might be new reporting that's coming out as I'm recording the show today. But it is like basically what's getting stripped out of the bill for this agreement as the stuff that it was going to kind of, you know, invest in climate infrastructure, which was such a key part of that infrastructure bill. Look, I mean, we're at the point of climate crisis here, and we do not have the infrastructure that is capable of meeting the challenges that face us. So this is like, you know, shit or get off the pot time. You either kind of put the, you know, money where your mouth is and invest in this stuff now, or we are in trouble. Last week, we reported about Miami being like, I guess we got to build that 20-foot seawall through the middle of our city if we're going to kind of stave off the kind of the impacts of climate change. Seriously. They're trying to do that at a city level because of the direct impacts. I mean, they don't have their heads in the sand anymore. As a matter of fact, their sand's going away. This is it. So this bill comes out about this new bipartisan proposal. And it's disgusting. And I was so happy to see Senator Markey again. He was on Chris Hayes last night. Senator Markey came on and basically was like, look, they gave a press conference after hearing about this new bipartisan, like, you know, group coming into some sort of agreement. Said, look, the indications are that there's not the climate stuff in there. And they said they will not vote for the bill. They, unless the climate infrastructure stuff is in the bill, they will not vote for it. Right. So Senator Markey, Sheldon Whitehouse sounded like he was in that camp. Right. And I'm sure that, you know, well, I'm not going to go down that route, but they're saying, look, this is it. This is the line in the sand. This is a red line. That's it. If you strip out that stuff for climate, we're not voting for the bill. And you know what that means, don't you? That means it's that much harder to get that infrastructure bill passed. Now, there's going to be people, there's going to be a lot of hand-wringing here. Oh, my God, they're going to ruin it. But what about the good stuff in the bill? And can't they do climate separately? No, you can't. You can't do climate separately because there is no more time. There's only so many bites of the apple that you're going to get. So if they try to take this new bipartisan thing and run it through reconciliation, that's it. There is no more reconciliation as an opportunity to get this through. And without the climate stuff, it is very unlikely that this is going to get 60 votes to beat a filibuster. And then if it does, that means that if Biden wants the climate stuff in there, He's going to have a climate-only bill go through reconciliation. And there are a bunch of oily, oily Democrats, like steeped in dollars from the petroleum industry, that will not vote for it. And they will not have the 50 votes. This is the time to fight this right now. This is the time to call our senators, call Bob Casey, even call Pat Toomey for that matter, if you really want to talk to Pat Toomey. This is the reason why. Because this is, I mean, this is it. I mean, this should be like, you know, our last stand. We shall see. We shall see. So that's coming up. If you haven't seen this story, it's coming out here. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this because, frankly, you know, I'm bored with Trump. And the fact that, you know, that the media, especially cable news, well, even for that matter, even the major print sources are still stuck on Trump. Because, you know, that it takes a while to get out of these things. I really don't care about the guy. Yes, there's implications of what he did. Yes, these things are important. The fact that we found out that Trump's Justice Department was secretly subpoenaing the phone records from Democrats like Adam Schiff and other folks. There was even one person who was members of the Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee, their families. And in one case, there was one of their family's kids, one of their kids, young kid, had their records subpoenaed too. And basically their phone records from Apple, right? And they subpoenaed it and then put a gag order on Apple and wouldn't let anybody know what was going on. And that expired like second week of May, I believe, right? That gag order. And so what was remarkable about this story, right, and there's a link for it in here to the New York Times story that broke last night, is that the investigation and the pulling of these orders and the secrecy, the subpoenaing, the secret, like, spying, basically, continued into the Biden administration under Merrick Garland, right? And now Merrick Garland is actually pushing back a little bit about talking about what actually happened, right? So something's screwy there. And a bunch of the people that were read into and that knew what this was going on, who worked at the Justice Department, they were not political appointees from Trump. They are still there. So that's going to be an ongoing story, and that's going to be an important story, right? But let's not kind of, like, you know, lose the forest through the trees, right? Is that it? Something like that? Let's not miss it. What the key thing is that what's happening here in terms of the legislation is absolutely critical. One last thing before we go to a little bit of a break. The big news was announced here that the Keystone XL pipeline is dead. Yep. The company that runs the TC Energy, who ran the Keystone XL pipeline, just basically said, look, we're done with the project. It's just too much. And if this is ever an example of direct action against the goods, This is it. And they shut down. And again, that was going to bring in kind of these very, very dirty tar sands from Alberta down through the country and then all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico for export. This is huge. And that is only more encouraging because right now you probably have seen this throughout the week. There's these big protests that are going on about this Line 3. The Line 3 is owned by Enbridge and is going to bring the same dirty tar sands from Canada down to the Gulf of Mexico. There are new kind of protesters that consist of First Nations, Native American tribes, environmentalists who are protesting Line 3. They were locking down on equipment at some pumping stations. You had a Homeland Security helicopter kind of get down real close to them, kind of like use the rotor blades to kind of that wash from the rotor blades, just throwing debris to try to get them out of there. The same tactic, by the way, that the Trump folks used on protesters in Lafayette Square a while back. But that's, again, I digress. So, you know, this is not over. This is northern Minnesota, and these protests are going to be kind of increasing over the summer. So this is a huge win to see if we stick with it, right, and we're willing to get into this even for years, that we can shut down these projects, right, and we have to at this point, right? The direct action is the only thing that we have, the guarantee that we can have an impact directly on kind of preventing
More fossil fuels being kind of burned right now. So huge win. Congratulations to everybody who's ever worked on fighting the Keystone XL pipeline. And now it's on to line three. Anyways, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about what's happening here in Pennsylvania and update on Pashi. And want to remind you that you can help support this show by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month. Just go to patreon.com/rcpress. You become a member or patron for as little as $5 a month. patreon.com/rcpress today. We'll be back right after this quick break.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1974. That was the day workers at the Dodge truck plant in Warren, Michigan, went out on a wildcat strike. Workers were fed up with the endless attacks from management and disappointing contract negotiations the year before. Wildcat strikes had become almost commonplace in Detroit-area auto plants the previous summer. Arbitrary discipline, deteriorating working conditions, and frustration with the union's response all led to the three-day walkout. 10 days earlier, 100 workers had staged a sick-in over working conditions. When the company threatened firings, more workers dropped their tools. Now, four had been fired, including the second shift chief steward. The response was immediate. Within an hour, the plant was virtually shut down. 6,000 workers voted to continue the strike. Wildcat leaders noted that virtually all the routine antagonisms among workers, young versus old, black versus white, women versus men, had melted away in solidarity. Socialist and anarchist workers in the plant published their recollections in a commemorative pamphlet entitled Wildcat, Dodge Truck, June 1974. In it, they state, quote, "We were excited by the collective decision of thousands of Chrysler employees to deny the authority of daily wage labor and, for even 4 days, to say no to the demands of the alarm clock, the production line, bosses, union bureaucrats, judges, and cops. It was, in fact, a total frustration with and rejection of all the things inside and outside the plant which exercise control over our lives." By the time it was over, 30 strikers had been arrested. Strike leaders were branded as communist agitators by the union, and area judges issued injunctions to end the picketing. The Wildcat may have failed, but workers had pushed back against management offensives.
Hey, welcome back. It's Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Back here going solo today as Sean Kitchen is on vacation. Today is actually, I think it's almost like launch week for the 2022 campaign, campaign season. Given what's the Pennsylvania GOP is doing on the floor this week. So I want to read you a little bit about this. This was just posted. This is from the Philadelphia Inquirer. Pennsylvania Republicans proposed a sweeping overhaul of the state's election system on Thursday, with lawmakers in the state house calling for stricter voter identification requirements, in-person early voting, signature verification of mail ballots, and other major changes. This was, yes, you've heard his name here multiple times, State Representative Seth Grove, chair of the House State Government Committee and House Republicans' point person for election legislation, introduced the bill after months of hearings with election administration's experts and voting rights activists. Now, we should put, you know, what the Philadelphia Inquirer did not do here is what we should do is put elections, you know, experts in quotes. All right. The legislation is sure to draw intense scrutiny and faces steep obstacles in GOP leaders. As GOP leaders who control both chambers of the legislature try to keep their party unified and also winning the approval of Democratic, you know, Governor Tom Wolf. So, you know, like the Wolf administration has already come out and called this an extremist proposal, which it is, and that's accurate, right? But let's be clear about what's happening here. So in addition to things I've already mentioned, so here's some of the changes. So you're going to require every voter to present ID at the polls, right? You're going to allow counties to begin processing and counting the mail ballots, what's known as pre-canvassing, 5 days before Election Day.
Okay. That's not necessarily a problem until you fit it in the whole. Anyways, create 6 days of in-person early voting beginning after the 2024 presidential election. Allow mail ballot drop boxes for 7 days before election day. Eliminate the permanent mailing voting list, the mail voting list. So you eliminate the permit. Well, yeah. Move the voter registration deadline to 30 days before election day from 15. That's actually a good move. I'm sorry, that's a bad move. It should be the voter registration deadline should be 30 days. It should be like the day of, right? Move the deadline for requesting mail ballots to 15 days before election day from 7. So again, giving people less time. Establish a Bureau of Election audits. Yes, the audit. Want to make audit a permanent feature of our what's going on in Arizona. Allow counties to open satellite election offices. Require signature verification for mail ballots. Require counties to purchase electronic poll books. Ban counties from accepting private donations for election administration. Increase poll worker compensation, well, which is a good thing, right? So now, okay, there's a whole bunch of stuff here. So you put all these things together, and here's this. So there's a few things in there, right, which are kind of potentially positive, right? You know, increase the payment to poll workers. Okay, you know, who's going to disagree with that, right? You know, a few things here and there. You might want to say, well, what's wrong with requiring every voter to present an ID at the polls? I hate that we have to go through this again. We had this last time this voter ID stuff goes on. Look, if you want to kind of mail everybody a voter ID, if you want to actually send people out to all registered voters, right? You want to, you know, I have a state program that is going to go say, hey, you know what? We're going to make sure that everybody has an ID. So here's our voter lists. We're going to send out nonpartisan, like, you know, civil servants to go to every single household and say, hey, you're going to need a voter ID when you go to the polls this year. We're here to give you one. And you've seen them. You could produce them on the spot, right? So here, you know, whatever, we'll do that for you. Like, the fact is, right, and if you haven't figured this out already, too, this is, you know, you should know this, is that most people in this country and in this state are not paying attention to the nitty-gritties of politics. Nope. Not happening. Right? And if you take the number of people who vote and who are registered to vote, right, and if you ask the majority of those people about, you know, how closely do you pay attention to politics, a lot of them are going to say, you know, around election time. Right? So you think about it. I'm just a person living my life, right? I watch lots of sports, right? You know, maybe I'm kind of like, you know, I'm spending most of my time kind of like, say, doing crafts or learning painting or whatever it might be, right? And I hate politics. But, you know, I'm an American. I'm going to vote. So about a week before the election, when people start really paying attention, you know, maybe 2 weeks before the election, I start like, oh, okay. Let me start seeing who's here. I'm going to try to learn who am I going to vote for this year. And I'm getting ready to vote. And I haven't been paying attention to all this minutia back here. And then I show up in the polls and I don't have this kind of correct voter ID. And then I go home. So you have to go home and get it, right? You go home and get it and you find out, well, you know, say you don't drive, right? You don't drive. So you don't have a driver's license, right? Or maybe you did have one, but, you know, it expired and you forgot to renew it because you don't drive. You bring it back, say, no, I'm sorry, this doesn't count. Right? Make it more and more of a hassle. The fact is that the people that are more likely to be impacted, remember we talked about in the first segment, right? You talk about outcomes. The outcomes are the people that are more likely, right, to be dissuaded from voting for something like this are going to be people who are poor, people of color, college students, right, who all just happen to be core Democratic Party constituents. Again, doesn't mean that they all are Democrats. It just means if you had to play the numbers, you're going to eliminate more Democrats than Republicans from voting, right? And you're going to have a disproportionate impact on communities of color. Bam, bam, bam. Right? That's what it is. So here you go. So, you know, this way. Now, this is why Governor Wolf has said this is an extremist position, because it is. Even though it's clouded or clothed in the language of neutral, like the neutral language of like, you everybody, right, whatever. That's not what's going on here.
It's never gone on like this. Again, watch Chris Hayes, read Carol Anderson, check that out. Okay. So that's happening. Governor Wolf will probably veto it if it kind of makes its way through, right, to his desk. And be clear about this too as well. The PA Republicans already know he's going to veto it, right? And their dreams, right? They're going to get a couple of, you know, a few of these kind of, you know, like heads in the sand conservative Democrats who kind of like, you know, don't realize what's actually really going on, right? Or benefit from the suppression of kind of black votes too, right? They don't want to be primaried, right? They're fine with the conservatives voting for them. So who knows? Who knows? Maybe in the perfect world for the Republicans, you get some of those Democrats to come over and vote with them to override the veto. I don't think that's going to happen, right? The Democrats are a little too savvy about this stuff right now, right? So why would you do it? If it's going to get vetoed and you're not going to get Democrats to come over, right? Unless some you know, perfect storm scenario. Why do you do it? Right? You do it for politics. You do it to set up the ground for the 22 election season, right? Remember, Governor Wolf is gone, right? You're going to have a kind of an open seat for governor, right? Pat Toomey, gone. There's going to be an open seat in the Senate. So there, and you've got all the statewide races, right? So what the Republican Party is doing right now in the state of Pennsylvania is they're setting themselves up for how they're going to run in 2022. And they're building their case. And they want Tom Wolf to veto this so that they could come out. That's why they're doing it. And they are going to try their best to get all the far-right crazies, the Trumpistas, out to vote. It is about, like, keeping the red meat out there as soon as possible and keeping everybody angry and in the conspiracy mind so they will come out and vote. That's what this is about. The same thing is also going down when it comes to anti-abortion legislation in the state. Again, once again, you know, in the same time frame, right, as they're getting ready to gear up for the 2022 vote, what are they doing? They're getting anti-abortion legislation. Right. And they're using the attack, the you know, Brian Sims was like, you know, he basically got shut down on the floor for calling these folks out. Basically said, what we see here in the Republican Party, what we see here as there's a party who is like carrying out a misogynist agenda here in a chamber that is 70% male. Wait, how did it go? A party that's 70% male in a chamber that is like, I don't know, like 90% white or something like that. Can't remember exactly how he framed it. But he's basically called out the Republican Party for the misogynistic agenda and it being basically a white identity party that had kind of racist stuff, and he was shut down on the floor. Right? That kind of made its rounds. But I mean, you watch what happened, right? I mean, you watch what happened this week in those hearings. It was kind of incredible. But let's be clear, right? Wolf has said over and over and over again that he will veto any of this kind of legislation that makes its way through there, right? They pass legislation, and they say, the Republicans say, like, hey, it's, you know, we'll make sure that you can't abort a Down syndrome kid because they have Down syndrome, right? They claim that it's about kind of like wanting to kind of, you know, defend the disabled, right? But of course, everything that all depends on you going along with them that saying the fetus is a person, right? And those bills have all failed before. So they're trying to kind of pull on your heartstrings in order to get you on this one, right? Sorry, not happening. Veto. Then you have the kind of the fetal burial legislation, right? That was all the big one. We talked about that last week too as well. The whole idea that, you know, if you have an abortion, right, or and I believe I'm right about this, or miscarriage, you, the woman, have to pay
for the burial of the fetus. Funeral costs. Right? That's insane. Right? But there you go. Here we go. So once again, we're going to see that. We're going to see that happen. Right? We're going to see. And because it's an open gubernatorial race, right, you're going to see these issues around abortion are going to be huge. And those Christian nationalists who keep on coming out to on the steps of Harrisburg, right, we're going to see more and more of them, right? Mark my words, is that we are going to see a ramping up of the right-wing kind of religious, the religious right in that conspiracy wing. They are going to be really super active in 2022, and they're moving up to 2022. So number one, you've got voter, right? You know, it's going to be this, you know, the vote, the election was stolen from Donald Trump, right? And we want to try to, you know, pass these voter, you know, the voter restriction laws, right? And the governor says no. So we need a Republican governor. That's the logic. That's the argument. Secondly, Tom Wolf has vetoed all the abortion stuff. So if you want to defend the rights of the fetus, right, then you got to get rid of that governor. Right? And third prong is you just saw that they, on the pandemic stuff, right, that they just pulled away. They just basically... First, they duped the the state electorate into kind of vote, giving the legislature the ability to kind of strip the governor of emergency declarations or put restrictions on it, at least. So that passed, and then they immediately use it, right? And so basically what they did is they voted to end Governor Tom Wolf's pandemic disaster declaration this week, right? And yet, you know, Republican Senate Majority Leader Kim Ward, you know, go out and say, yeah, look, for all practical purposes, state of emergency is over. 100% open. Go, go, go. Right? Which is crazy. Right? And at the same time, restricting the PA health secretary from being able to kind of mandating stay-at-home orders and things like this, like doing their job. Right? That feeds into this other wing of the conspiracy theory, folks, around masking, around the fake pandemic, about, you know, those people testifying in Congress about how they're magnetized, even though they can't get the key to stick to their face, like, but they're still magnetized, right? And the, you know, 5G is kind of going to activate them. I just couldn't believe it, right? Like, and they were serious. They were quote unquote experts. Right, about, you know, the magnetizing effects of the you know, vaccine. Crazy. So they're there, right? And so then you've got these folks. So you've got those three things. You got one, right, around voting and Donald Trump was, you know, had the election stolen from. That's gonna be the first prong. Second prong is gonna be around abortion. They're gonna go hard on the kind of misogynist agenda for there. And then third, it's gonna be about what happened during the pandemic and ramping up everything around this anti-masker stuff, right? That's what we're facing. And that is why you see this summer, right, so much attention being focused right now on those issues, right? What they're designed to do is reinforce the most rabid conspiracy theorists and right-wing neo-fascists in the state, right, in order to kind of keep them active, in order to kind of have a takeover, you know, a further takeover of the governor's office, right? But then deepen the red throughout the rest of the state, and also in the Senate, right? Because look, the money that's going to be already flowing in, and it will continue to flow in, right? They have national agenda there too as well, and they know there's an open Senate seat here, so they need the highest voter turnout from the people that are most passionate on the right, in order to try to kind of win the governor's mansion, right? And then to win that Senate seat. So be prepared, right? If you want to, this is all time. This is why we're going to have more progressive candidates on, like, you know, we had Colleen Gray win on this past Monday on Out to Coop Live. And you're hearing some more of those folks because, like, we need to get behind these candidates now and start building out that organization stuff now. Okay. The last thing I'll talk about, and if you saw the PASHA hearings this week,
You know, I spent a lot of time for several weeks in a row looking at the Pashi hearings, and we're gonna come back to that. We're gonna come back to what's happening with these consolidation plans in a more thorough way. I'm not gonna go down the Pashi rabbit hole right now too much. But remember, there was this comment period. There was like a 60-day comment period where, once the Board of Governors said we'll vote kind of to get behind this the Chancellor's plan to consolidate, or at least kind of move it forward. They didn't actually approve it. They have to go through this comment period first. So now they had their comment. They started having their comment, the comment periods where the public can weigh in. And there's two takeaways, right? The first takeaway was you had faculty members and students, mostly faculty members and students, right? But there were members of the community too as well. There were kind of staff members, right, from the universities, who came on and talked about why they thought this plan was, you know, there's a lot of people said this is moving way too quickly, for example. That's kind of one kind of group of things. A lot of folks are just completely against it. Great points were made. I mean, there were people who were having trouble with their internet connections during the comment period. And they were like students or faculty members who are in those areas that where those schools are located, in those rural areas that are being proposed to merge and to have a whole bunch of the classes being sent online. And they were having trouble connecting there. And that's not even during the semester, right? And like, as someone who taught during that, I can't tell you how many times that we had to deal with that, right? There were faculty members that came on and talked about how they saw students' grades drop off when they had to be virtual for the whole time. What's gonna mean now you're gonna force a whole bunch of those students to go virtual? What's gonna happen to the communities when they're loss of business? A whole bunch of that kind of stuff. It was right across the board. And Bill Schachter did a fantastic job of kind of reporting on this stuff. So I just wanted to kind of read a little bit of this to you if you haven't seen this already, and then we'll move on. So here it is. So this is from yesterday's Post-Gazette, Bill Schachter. So with all four public hearings now in the books, upwards of 100 individuals have weighed in on controversial plans to merge six public universities belonging to the state system of higher education. Of them, one speaker endorsed the idea and the rest unleashed a torrent of criticism. As with hearings on Wednesday, which were held on Zoom, commenters Thursday warned that the plan due for a final vote in mid-July is not finished and also muddled, these are quotes, and rushed. They said students in rural parts of Pennsylvania who already have fewer educational options would be among the hardest hit, as state campuses intended to make higher education accessible, merge programs and departments. It will push students to take a greater share of their courses remotely, they said, creating what one professor called, quote, second-class students, unquote, unable to join peers in classes that are split between those face-to-face and others participating online from up to 150 miles away. Issues with the plan aside, multiple speakers asked why state system leaders, including Chancellor Dan Greenstein, Board Chairwoman Cynthia Shapira, and others are not fighting the legislature more aggressively for better funding. The Pennsylvania General Assembly provided colleges with less aid per capita than all but three other states, its near bottom ranking barely half the national funding average. This is so critical, this part. This is why I wanted to read this. Quote, this is... quote, my first point is, why are you letting them off the hook? Asked Kutztown University professor Daniel Spiegel. Quote, before any reorganization occurs, it is up to the legislature of this commonwealth to decide if they are willing to fund higher education at an appropriate and responsible level, unquote. He said erosion of robust offerings would undermine campuses, devastate communities whose economies rely on the campuses, and potentially set many of the six schools up for eventual closure. Quote, these schools will be gutted academically, unquote, he said. In all, about 8 hours of testimony were offered, including Thursday afternoon session that stretched nearly double the planned 90 minutes allotted. Some waited in the queue for as long as 2 hours to speak. Right. And it goes on. This is ultimately the case right here, right? This is what the deal is. What Dan Spiegel said there, all the full disclosures, friend of mine. I work with him closely in the union at Kutztown. But he's absolutely right. This is all these plans, these consolidation plans, have just like allowed the Board of Governors and allowed university presidents, allowed the Chancellor's Office and all this stuff to just basically ignore the main issue here. And that has to do that we're dealing with a legislature who will not adequately fund public higher education in this state. And they want to destroy it. And there's no way of getting around that. We talked about the Perry report that came out of the University of Massachusetts, which basically showed what the impact was going to be of job losses. That's primarily what it is, what these plans are. Redesign means downsizing. Redesign is the same thing, as it says in that report, as plant closures. It is about reducing the number of faculty and staff at the universities, period. And, you know, Daniel Greenstein could dress it up in all the kind of like glorified, you know, like Silicon Valley draped discourse he wants. Right. But that's ultimately what is going on here at its core. And it's because of the state legislature. So we can pretend we are spending all this time and freaking money devoted to like system redesign, when really what we need is a coordinated, organized effort for public higher education in this state. And yes, I've been saying this for 10 years. We've been saying it for 10 years. People have been trying to advocate. But I mean, you know, time's up. It's now or never. Right? That's where the focus has to be. And that's a great question. Why are we letting them off the hook? So that's kind of the main core of kind of what came out from this. And this fight is only going to continue now. It's only going to ramp up. And my guess is that you're going to Chancellor Greenstein is going to be in for a little bit more pushback than he has suspected. And I think part of it has to do with his actual behavior during these hearings. He's like, you started seeing images show up on Twitter, right? And if you watched any of the hearings, you saw it live, right? But they could do screen captures of what was going on. Good chunks of the hearing, he was just sitting down and like texting friends and like practically laughing. Right. And then he'd look up. Oh God, are they seeing me? It's like, I swear to God, it's like students in my class who sit there with their phone in their lap, texting friends and smiling. Right. I actually have something in my syllabi. Right. Which is kind of like, you know, I call it like a pro tip. Right. I said, if you're in class and you're looking down in your lap, you're not paying attention to class, you're looking down in your lap, you're moving your hands and you're smiling, only one of two things is taking place at that point, and neither one of them is appropriate for the class. Right? And that's what he was doing. He was just like that arrogant little rich kid. It's almost always like that, right? Who thinks that they don't have to play by the rule. They don't have to pay attention. They don't have to do this because they've already got it in the bag. They're just going through the motions, sitting there texting, smiling. When he looks up, then he looks up with a grim face. Then goes back down and starts like practically chuckling as he's texting people, happy texting people on his phone. And that kind of arrogance does not go over well. That kind of dismissive attitude only reinforces what faculty and staff and students have been saying throughout this whole process, that he didn't give a shit about them. He didn't listen. He already had his agenda, went through the motions, but didn't listen for anything. All that work and all that input went nowhere because he's that arrogant. And sure enough, there it was on display. He didn't feel he needed to listen to faculty and students and staff and parents, because he feels he's already got it in the bag. He did the behind-the-scenes work of the charm offensive, getting all the key players on board, and us, the people, mean crap to him. Why do you think students kept on saying things like, we never saw him on our campus? He says he talked to us too. Who? Wasn't me. So expect there to be more fallout when I hear. But, I mean, look,
we're getting close to the deadlines here, right? So this is, I think in the, let me see where he says this here. Mid-July, right, is when the vote is. So we're going to see a lot of pressure. So now is the pressure point for those folks who are organizing. Check out PASHI Defenders, certainly. Make sure you're following ABSCUF. Make sure you're finding Save Our State Schools, right, on Twitter. I'll make sure those things are in the show notes. But these are the folks that you need to be paying attention and getting plugged into as part of this kind of organized resistance. All right, so I'm going to take another quick break, and we're going to come back with today's last call. Do stick around for today's last call, because I got to talk about a couple kind of programming notes coming up, which are pretty cool. I promise I'll go short on the space stuff today. A couple key things, which are actually going to feed into one of the things I want to talk about, today's last call. But some of the shows that are coming up and some of the things we're going to be doing over the summer, I'm very excited to talk about. So hope you stick around for that. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. We want to remind you, you can become a patron for as little as $5 a month. Just go to patreon.com/RCPress today and become a patron. Make sure you subscribe to our YouTube channel. Make sure you like the stream and make sure you hit that notification bell so you know every time that we go live. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. We'll be right back. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. For the past 7 years, Raging Chicken Press has brought pull-no-punches, progressive reporting, and commentary to the interwebs. Our long-form investigative pieces, stories that no access journalist wants to touch, or rollicking weekly podcasts strive to advance progressive movements and perspectives rooted in the struggles happening across the country or down the street. We've broken national stories and caused our share of discomfort in the halls of power. If we want a progressive future, we need progressive media. And you can help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. We need to make sure to keep the movement in the media and the media in the movement. Best way you can do that is to become a member of Raging Chicken today by going to patreon.com/rcpress. Thank you for your energy, your encouragement, and your support. Keep up the fight. Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast, and it's our last call, where normally we talk beer news, we talk space news, a bunch of other stuff to see what's going on. today in space news, let me get through my space news pretty quickly. I want to actually line this up real quickly, because I do want to, I have a little fun thing that I want to do. Like I said, you know, it's, there we go. Okay. So on today's space news, a couple things kind of come. This folds into, I'm going to put actually a couple things together here. So some things have been so happening in kind of the space industry, right? So one is that Jeff Bezos just announced that he's going to space with his brother, right? And they're actually raffling off a third seat, right? The third seat, and right now it's going for something like $2.8 million. You know, just like for the people, right? For the people. And they talk about democratizing space. And I'm like, okay, sure. Right? It's a democracy for you. $2.8 million to go to space. Sure, yeah, I can handle that. Anyways, so, you know, Jeff Bezos, as one of his kind of side projects, has been to, been working on Blue Origin. Blue Origin is, you know, the Amazon space program, or actually Jeff Bezos, to be fair, it's his company, his space company. He just recently threw a hissy fit for the fact that Blue Origin did not get one of the contract or a contract to to build the lunar lander. They were, you know, outbid and outperformed by SpaceX, and so they threw up all these kind of like, you know,
But, you know, through public fits, and we kind of went to Congress, sent lobbyists and all this, threatened to sue and all this kind of stuff, to the point where Congress was coming back and saying, oh, maybe we do have another $10 billion around here to kind of, you know, float, or $10 billion, I think, whatever, a $10 million contract just kind of float for Amazon to make sure we have a second one, whatever. So that's all good in there. And just the way that he was talking about this, about the Blue Origin flight, where he's actually going to go on, right? They've been testing for years now. And to a lot less fanfare than SpaceX, right? In part because they've just been testing it in the desert and they haven't really been doing anything with it, right? Where SpaceX has been, you know, yes, they tested all the rockets. We see these, you know, the explosion of the Starship, but they're actually kind of like sending rockets back and forth to the, you know, space station and reusing them. They're sending people to space, to the space station, right? Back and forth, right? And they've been doing it, continue to lower the cost of these missions. And so, you know, I mean, you can't blame NASA for saying, well, you know what? We're going to go with the people who are already doing it, right? And they're actually underbidding the rest of the companies, right? So you can understand all that. But anyway, so he threw a hissy fit about Blue Origin. And you wonder, like, well, you know, what's all this up and down? So why are they doing all this testing? And it turns out, I really do believe that this is 100% one of his vanity projects. The idea about getting the lunar lander and all that kind of stuff, I think it is only, that's secondary to what he's actually doing here. He personally gets to go to space because it was his boyhood dream. Right? And you have an entire space infrastructure, a company that is built around the desires of billionaires. Right? SpaceX, billionaire Musk. Blue Origin, billionaire Bezos. Right? Then you've got a bunch of these other companies that are involved in it too as well. You've got some smaller companies. You got like Rocket Lab, which is kind of a really interesting company that's both based in US and is based in New Zealand. You've got, you know, anyways, I don't want to go down a rabbit hole here, but that's who is defining this next stage of what's happening in space. All right. You got to watch that video from Bezos, if you have, from his Instagram, because it's really hard to take, you know, for like non-billionaire people, even some of these images, just whatever. Anyways, so there's that. In NASA news, right, and I swear to God, this is all connected in some way. In NASA news, they're talking about, say, Russia may pull out of the International Space Station, right? So Russia has been a partner of the U.S. On the space station since its formation back in the early days. They've been a constant presence. And, you know, Russia, you know, for the longest time had been the only other kind of major space power, if you will. Right. They had a huge space presence, just like you. I mean, obviously, the Russians were the first ones to put anything in orbit. Sputnik. Right. So this goes back to the beginning. The reason why we landed someone on the moon was because of the space race. Right. Against the Soviet Union at that time. Right. So Russia began the space race before the U.S. ever did. Right. And so, and that's been, you know, once we kind of transitioned with the International Space Station, we were actually doing more in partnership as opposed to competition and so on. Well, there's concerns right now. There has been growing concerns that we're about to enter this kind of nationalistic phase of the space race. Right. In part because China is now emerging as a third major player. Right. They just, you know, we've covered this on the show before. They've launched the first module of the space station. Remember, there was a big concern about, you know, they just let their, you know, the rocket fairing come back in an uncontrolled descent when nobody knew where it was going to land. but they have a second piece that's going up there. And I kept on going back and had to reread this, but they're planning on, you know, before the fall, they're planning actually sending astronauts up there. Whatever you call the Chinese astronauts. I'm not sure if I'm saying the right term for it, but it's like, so they're planning on manning their space station, right? Real quickly. Right. And they have major lunar ambitions. So you have Bill Nelson, the NASA administrator, gave several interviews this week about being very concerned about, you know, this development that Russia's threatening is probably the wrong word, but they're saying, yeah, look, we might just pull out of this. We don't want to be part of it anymore. Right. The question is like, well, okay, does that mean they're going to partner with China now?
and what is that actually going to look like for the future of space stuff? And obviously, everyone who's in the kind of military industrial complex starts kind of, you know, seeing dollar signs at that point, because they're like, oh, space race, right? Where this is going to be, this is going to be great. We're gonna have the a good old fashioned national space race. And of course, you know, people are going to start talking about militarizing of space, right? Because to defend national interest in space and all this stuff. There's a renewed interest in kind of like having to figure out international treaties. Now, because remember, there's a law in the U.S. that basically forbids the United States from entering into partnerships with China, right, in commercial ventures or things like this, right? So that's why China and the U.S. do not work together on space stuff, right? Because they're prevented from this law. They can do it with Russia, but they can't do it with China because it's a communist country, right? So there's that. So that's good, preventing it. So that there's a barrier there, which means we're automatically, you know, saying, because the ideal scenario, in my view, right, is that, you know, if you're imagining a different, like, environment for space, you look at the International Space Station as an example of where you're actually, in practice, people working together across national boundaries, right, towards some sort of common goal, right? And it's been like, whatever, it's been talked a lot about. It's been an anniversary of the space station this year, and a lot of discussion about that, and kind of like the kind of collaborative work and so on. But by that legislation, as prevents us to work from China, is actually now splitting it, right? So now we're going to see competition between nations are there. And all that is happening at the same time that we're seeing like the commercialization of space, right? Insofar as this morning, when I was kind of looking at some of the stuff for this show, there was an ad by Morgan Stanley, right? Yes, that Morgan Stanley. For the emerging space economy, right, and space investment and so on. And I do believe it is going to be an explosive economic space. Well, that's not a good word for it, right? But you're going to see the explosion of the space economy in my lifetime, your lifetime. So anyways, that's why these people are getting involved. So you have these kind of national interests, right, on top, and happening at the same time that you're seeing the opening up the commercialization of space that is dominated by either military contracting like Lockheed Martin and those kind of companies, or by these billionaire companies, right? At the edge of that, you've got another layer of, say, you know, venture capitalists and kind of emergent companies who are even thinking further down the road, right? They're looking at like mining on the moon. They're looking at the retrieval of minerals and kind of elements and things like this on asteroids, right? As a way to do this. And, you know, we reported this on the show a while back where there was just an asteroid where they were able, the first ever time they were able to go to an asteroid and return samples back, right? Analyze what was going on. And they found that, you know, you're talking about like nickel, and I want to say magnesium. I'm not sure if that was that, I'm remembering that right, but I know one of them was nickel. But basically the elements were on that one asteroid, right, was worth like several trillion dollars. So if you're a long-term thinker and you see that there's this kind of like opening up of this commercial infrastructure in orbit and then on the moon, and you're thinking like, okay, I'm going to play for 20 years down the road. I'm going to start working now about how to get stuff from those asteroids. There's a company called Planetary Resources that I actually started using a few years back in one of my classes to kind of just as an example to look at, say, research example, but I won't go into that. But who are already doing that work and raising money on it, right? And that was like 3 years ago. So all that is about to happen, right? Yet another piece of there is that we're seeing a reworking of international treaties around space exploration, right? The space treaty, which had been signed, the United Nations Space Treaty, that has governed, for lack of a better word, how we explore space, basically said you cannot own a planetary body or parts of a planetary body. So you could not go to the moon and say, this is like, you know, USA Lunar, and plant your flag and say, this is our nation, we're going to defend it. We're saying that can't be owned, right? NASA, under the Trump administration, under Jim Bridenstine's work, they were the first to begin chipping away at that by saying, we're going to have the Artemis Accords. The Artemis Accords about the terms by which we go to the moon, right, and what happens on the moon and how we govern that. That was a NASA-initiated treaty or accord, right? It was not done through the United Nations. It was not done through, like, a global body. It was done from a U.S. body. So there's a breaking down, at least, of that infrastructure. And I suspect, I expected this, because what happens is that that's all fine and good, right? You know, we all, you know, we're not going to own things and stuff like this out there until it becomes practical. And then when it becomes practical, then you see this kind of nonsense, right? The same extractivists that have destroyed our planet are looking to get in the game for what's happening off planet. So, having said that, I just wanted to say this. I've teased this for a while, but I think that was a good time for it. So, we do a little space news at the end of our weekly roundup. So I'm going to do a show. It might be just like once monthly, right? And I've got a cool graphic that I'm working on right now. So I was going to show you it today, but it's not what I don't like it yet. So, but for what I'm calling it at this point is going to call it Space Left, right? And we're going to try to build a critical discussion around what's happening in kind of the space. You've heard me talk about on the show is like my approach to look at this stuff is to think about this as this is kind of galactic capitalism. And it right now, it's galactic capitalism in a complete, like, unregulated space. And that is going to have huge consequences for, like, my kids, your kids, if you have kids. Next generations. The major consequences might not happen during our lifetime, but I believe it is on its way to happen. And all those elements that I just talked about are the reasons why I believe that. And so if you can imagine, just take that asteroid I talked about. You have one asteroid that has trillions of dollars of wealth. We're going to run out of certain minerals. Let's say we are able to actually pass some monumental legislation when it comes to climate change. And we're going to have the ramping up of solar panels and all this other kind of stuff, right? Well, a lot of the things that go into solar panels are mined under not great conditions, right? So they require the things that go in our phones, right? Computers, technology. This is stuff that is all mined. And there doesn't seem to be a kind of, I mean, there's like, you know, quote, very small M movement that's saying that we need to move away from this kind of highly technological kind of world, right? But all indications are we're going full throttle, right? And more technology, more of this. We're going to need more of these minerals. So eventually those run out or become too expensive. If you can be the company or the individual, right, or the nation that can go and grab that $1 trillion-plus asteroid and be the one who is going to dole out those resources. Number one, you can either make it extraordinarily cheap, right? For everybody, right? You say, hey, look, we got this asteroid. It belongs to everybody. Look, right? Or you can control it and profit. That second part, the profit one, is the direction that we're headed right now. And we've moved, I believe, at the realm from science fiction to when we start what I would call like science rhetoric, right? We're actually kind of having to combat or see things being worked out at the level of policy, right? And so when that happens, when it starts being not fictional, but actually starts something that being is happening, is getting worked out in the real world, right? Then that's a place we need to be paying attention to, right? Because the last thing we need to do is kind of get behind the eight ball, right, when it from the left about what this determines. Like, there's every reason in the world to rail on these billionaire dreams like Jeff Bezos about he gets his childhood dream to go into orbit. I get it. There is all the reason in the world to look at people that are starving on the streets and say, why the hell are we investing any money in space? I get it. If, however, we're serious about things like modern monetary theory, right, which basically shows us that the money is there. We're only limited by capacity and resources, human resources, right? We're not limited by we don't have the money. It's about will. Right? That's why we could right now write the check to invest in our caring infrastructure. And there will be people to fill it. And there's a capacity there and there's a need. So that won't lead to crazy inflation and so on. The same principle applies, at least for fiat currencies like in the United States, when it comes to the kind of comes to space. These things are not necessarily in opposition to one another. Feeding the poor and going to space. Right? And you've got a highly motivated and resourced billionaire class that is already doing it. And who's going to control that? Right? So Space Left is going to be a space for this, about developing that conversation. And the reason why I'm doing it now is this, because, you know, I'm working on developing a course at Kutztown University. It's going to be called Space Rhetorics or something like this. And we're going to, exactly those problems that I just laid out is what we're going to be tackling in that class. We're going to be reading policy. We're going to be reading, you know, some of the kind of like the foundational text on this. We're going to be reading some of the theories and some of the criticism that's going on. And hopefully in this show, begin to kind of even bring on some people to talk about like this kind of perspective. Like the question that is burning for me to answer right now, which I've been reaching out to some people about, is that why is it that the right wing seems to be consistently pro space? Like Mike Pence, for example, is a huge space head, right? And I suspect, I have no evidence of this at this point, but I suspect that there are some really deep threads that are woven through like way crazy religious stuff woven into this kind of like manifest destiny stuff. It's all bottled up in that, but I haven't found somebody yet that is doing some of that I could talk to about. So I keep on searching for it. If you know of something like that, let me know. So that's the other big news, right? So we got, so Space Left will be at another program. So you see what's happening here, right? At Raging Chicken, right? We're increasing the number of Out to Coop live interview shows, right? We've got, you know, a freaking amazing like lineup coming here. We've got Cory Doctorow coming on Monday. We've got the Kadita Kenner coming on Wednesday. We've got Aaron Wallace from Pink Boot Society and the Devil's Den in Philadelphia coming out to talk about craft beer industry stuff on the following Monday, the 21st. We've got, like I said here, you know, there it is, right? Can Labor Break Its Double Bind? Chris Masano is going to come on for a pre-record. We've got, excuse me, Dana Morrison and Eleni Shermer coming on to talk about, say, the debt that's being held by colleges and universities across the country, and more. On Wednesdays, we've got the Wednesday show with Cyril Mikulenko, right? This is become, a regular feature. Cyril and I first talked about this. Oh, we'll do this on kind of like maybe every other week, maybe once more. We'll see what goes like that. Said, nah, you know, let's run it, right? There seems to be enough desire for that kind of show, and it's been doing extraordinarily well. Right. I mean, we get great feedback on it and great. So that's all good. So that's all coming up. This is why you're going to also see some increased pitches from me. Right. So look, if you can become a patron of this show by going to patreon.com/RC press, please do. Right. I can also tell you there's been some preliminary, that is the wrong word. Is that I've had some discussions with some people that are kind of connected in, say, different, say, media environments and also in podcasting environments, looking for different ways of kind of building out this network, right? And actually seriously thinking about how do we make this more sustainable for a specific progressive project, right? We shall see where that goes. But all that is like saying, you know, look, the great thing about the summer for me is that I get to do this more. Right, that I get to spend more of my time devoted to thinking about how to do this. I do some of that background infrastructural work. When my job starts, when I go back to school in the fall, right, then it's about doing the show. And there's not a lot of time to kind of do some of the infrastructure work and background work. Right. In my perfect world, I'd be able to do more of this all throughout the year. And sometimes that would mean bringing more people on to supporting it, to actually, you know, imagine if we could hire people at Raging Chicken, that would be freaking amazing, right? To have a producer so that I could actually do the show and not have to do all the technological stuff during the stuff here too as well. All that stuff would be great. But that could only happen with your support. So if you can become a patron for as little as $5 a month, go to patreon.com/rcpress. Thank you to all the people who have been supporting us right from the beginning, or if you just became a patron this past month. Thank you, thank you, thank you. It's what helps keep this going. Last word, I just want to give a closing shout out again. I know I did it at the beginning of the show too as well, but I do want to give a closing shout out to the folks at Notch Brewing. Like I said, I reached out to them after the story from Brianna Allen kind of exploded when she put out that story on Instagram about sexism in the craft brewing industry. She's one of their brewers. She's their production manager. And she has said again and again in her Instagram that basically, look, she's not talking about Notch Brewing. The Notch Brewing has been extraordinarily supportive, right? And they have been, it's been a great place to work. And they've even come out and basically said, look, every place is, you know, had issues. We've had some issues that we probably didn't handle in the way that we should have in the past. It's got us rethinking about those things. They've been explicit about that. They've come out as a brewery and said that, right? And there was no like accusations of wrongdoing, or at least what I find out so far. And so I said, you know what? I just wanted to reach out to them since we're not doing the craft beer recommendations right now. I thought, well, look, if she's the woman who broke this, she's been part of the Pink Boots Society too as well. And she's saying that that Notch is a good place to be. I'm going to support them. I'm going to give them a shout out. And it turns out, I wanted to order some things. I think we've been going back and forth on this. And just as I was talking to them, they came out with a new beer that is called Brave Noise, right? I'm just going to read what they have posted here, right? They have a picture of Brianna. She's actually holding out the can in front of her. It says Brave Noise Pale Ale. I'll read it to you. It says, it is brewed to show solidarity for all those that have suffered discriminatory behavior in the workplace. Now available at our Salem Tap Room and Beer Garden in 16-ounce 4-packs and on draft. The release party featuring Lager Dog Official, that's a hot dog place, official, and donations opportunities for the Pink Boots Society starts at 6 p.m. So they're actually having an in-person fundraiser as this can is getting released, and it's going to help support that. So I'm seeing if I can get them sent. It is listed. You can actually mail order stuff from Notch Brewing to Pennsylvania. And if you want to help support that, you can go to Brave Noise and you can do it through there, and kind of let them know and let them know, please let them know that Raging Chicken sent you if you go over there. Cause I want them to know too, as well, that other people are paying attention to that example. And then one of the things I want to be talking about with Erin Wallace, when she comes on the show on the 21st about craft brewing, particularly in PA, but what, you know, the sexism in the industry and so on, is to start looking for those breweries that we know or that are doing the right thing, that we know are actively combating this stuff, not just like passively, but actively combating this stuff. We want to start supporting them kind of more directly on the show. So that's all coming up too as well. So shout out to Notch Brewery, and a shout out to Rob Hughes. Rob Hughes is their kind of marketing manager who I've been back and forth with. So I really appreciate the discussion, Rob. And shout out to Brianna there too as well. Brianne as well. So that's all I got. Thank you all for tuning into the show. Thank you all to who are kind of, longtime listeners. It's been great. I almost had, today as a call-in show today as well, but I just didn't do it. I thought I was going to go short, and I did not. So anyways, look, it's been a great time, everybody. I hope that you're as excited as I am about what's coming up on the show. Please tune in on Out to Coop Live on Monday at 7 p.m. to hear Cory Doctorow. We're going to talk about his book, How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism, and some of his fiction writing about the same stuff too as well. As always, thanks to all our supporters who have been there right from the beginning. And I look forward to everything that is to come. Have a great weekend, everybody. Looks like we got some of the break of the heat. I'm looking forward to it. And we'll see you on Monday. See ya!